From KQED and the California Report, this is Capitol Notes, a weekly roundup of California politics from the state capitol in Sacramento.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Capitol Notes, the Capitol Notes podcast. Actually, a special edition here as we tape this on Wednesday, the 22nd of August, and the budget is a done deal. And Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, is here with me. It's just a two-man show this time. And it's over. It's over.
Wow, somebody wake me when it's over, and now they've awoken me.
Now, did we do a prediction for this one or not? Because, you know, we were going to say we were going to get back in the prediction business. I don't know if we did.
We might have said Labor Day. I think if we did make a prediction, I think we might have been... So I'll say no. I'll say no, we did not make
a prediction. Okay, good. And someone will catch us on this. One of the eight listeners will, the gang of eight, the rule of eight.
Modesto Bureau, we're looking at you.
These are all inside jokes, and clearly if you get them, we appreciate it. You're listening to the podcast over the last few weeks. Well, let's talk about the budget deal. It came together on Tuesday, where the deal came together before that, but the vote was on Tuesday in the Senate, and all of the accompanying language of the deal had to go back through the Assembly. On to Governor Schwarzenegger, and of course, as we are recording this, we have not seen the line item vetoes yet, but we'll tackle that in next week's podcast along with the other political news. Let's just talk about how this whole thing ended. I mean, it was, I just have to say, this was the most anticlimactic ending to a budget impasse, and it was one of the strangest budget impasses that I can remember. I mean, what comes to your mind?
Well, we've talked about this for the last 4 weeks at least, about how much of this seemed to be about egos and personality as much as it was about philosophy. I mean, certainly from a monetary point of view, there was not a whole lot of concessions made by the Democrats or the governor in this newly revised budget. And so when that was clear, it became about CEQA reform, the California Environmental Quality Act reform. First, it was about this lawsuit that Jerry Brown had filed against San Bernardino County, trying to force compliance with AB 32, the new greenhouse gas law. And then it became about bond projects, which there were some small concessions on some of that language. Details too boring to get into even for our podcast listeners.
Well, slightly not too boring, because in a moment I want to talk about that, but fair enough.
Okay. I think they're too boring, but yeah. John doesn't.
Never for public radio. But continue with your sermon.
But yes. I think Democrats were frustrated. They were looking for a silver bullet, trying to find a way out of this budget problem. And, you know, their take was that the Senate Republicans kept moving the goalposts. We finally got a deal Monday morning. It was sort of the whole budget issue in microcosm when Dick Ackerman came out, Senate Republican leader Dick Ackerman came out of a Big Five meeting out of the governor's office and announced to the press that they had a deal. They called a session that night, and guess what? The Senate Republicans weren't there.
There was no deal. And I know where they were because I was at the table next to them.
They were at Chops eating artichoke dip.
They were at Chops sitting out on the patio. And it's, you know, there's an interesting story. That whole thing was right. We all waited for this deal on Monday. We were all told the deal had happened. And then we kept waiting for something to happen and waiting for something to happen. And language was being drafted and language was being, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the first sign, as I remember, of the thing kind of unraveling, at least on Monday, was after the Big Five meeting, the governor and the four legislative leaders, where Speaker Nunez comes out and says, we've got a deal and it's a great deal. And Senator Ackerman walks out later and says, no, we're not there yet. and the whole press corps looks at each other and goes, what? And a few hours later, walking around in the hallway of the Capitol, you start to hear Democrats say this thing is off, and they were ticked off at Republicans. Right. And then you start to hear stories that there's a group of Republicans over at Chops, which is the steakhouse across from the Capitol, if you're not a Sacramentan. And I walked over there, and there were about four or five other reporters. We actually sat at a table, kind of kitty-cornered, from the Republican senators, and just sat there.
With open ears and notebooks.
It was like the cheesiest private eye movie you've ever seen, you know, like where it's obvious who the private eye is watching the person. We're sitting there like, you know, I admit I had a Diet Coke. I didn't have a beer at that time. But we were sitting there watching the guys and just trying to figure out what they were doing, and they seemed to be in a pretty good mood. I don't want to say they were celebrating or anything. I think Senator Parada called it celebration the next day, but I'm not sure it was celebration. But they clearly were there in solidarity. There were seven of them at the time. And then Senator Ackerman, the Republican leader, joined them, and there was eight, so they had a majority right there. There were jokes about violating public acts of open meetings, and anyway, that joke kept going. But yeah, they were there, and they were in no hurry. And when you heard that there was a Senate floor session that night, 20 minutes later, and these guys were still sitting there, I knew it wasn't going to happen. And then, right, we all went home, and Tuesday there was marginally little difference in what happened. I mean, the big concession that didn't happen, from what I understand, was school equalization. There was this whole proposal that Republicans wanted money for suburban school districts. Part of this issue, if you don't know this, friends who are wonkish, about equalization of school funding. And Republicans wanted more money for suburban school districts, and the CTA didn't like part of the deal, from what I hear. Right. And the deal never happened, and so the Republicans gave that up, and they gave up the votes. And, yeah, as you look at this deal, you've got a $145 billion budget. It is the same budget, at least the budget itself, that passed out of the Assembly a month ago. Mm-hmm. And the small little side deals to it, to determine, are they enough to merit the impasse that went on? Now, I don't want to go too wonkish into the CEQA thing, but I do think there's an interesting part to that. Fellow listeners who haven't followed this wholeheartedly, this is the notion of protecting construction projects from global warming lawsuits. And all they got were construction related to the transportation bonds and the levy bonds passed by voters. But what I find fascinating is that there are a whole group of environmentalists and others who have looked at what the deal actually says and think it actually strengthens CEQA lawsuits against AB 32, because for the first time it makes a connection between this decades-old law, CEQA, and AB 32, global warming, in which case the Republicans may be sorry they got what they asked for.
Right, and my understanding, correct me on this one, is that there's a three-year moratorium on lawsuits.
I think it's a two-year moratorium.
Is it 2 years?
Mm-hmm. Sunsets in 2010.
Oh, right. Here we are halfway through 07. Two and a half, split the baby. And two and a half fiscal years. But making that linkage at all by creating a sunset, the fact that it expires then perhaps opens the door to those lawsuits. So, I think a lot of people certainly even – what was interesting about this year, one more way in which it was different than other years, so often once a budget deal is reached, the acrimony kind of subsides. You know, there's a lot of palling around, everybody declaring victory. And
the Assembly was like that on Tuesday night.
When the Assembly was like that
morning.
On July 20th.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But it certainly wasn't the case this time. I mean, you listen to the quotes from Fabian Nunez and Don Parada.
Especially Parada.
Directed at Dick Ackerman and the Senate Republican caucus, it didn't seem like the hatchet had been buried at all. And if it had been, it was maybe in one another's backs. I mean, they don't seem to have made much peace going forward. I think it's probably this standoff has poisoned the well for the last couple of weeks of the legislative session.
Yeah, there was some discussion about that. Parada, the president pro tem of the Senate, if you don't follow us always, called a press conference after the budget vote on Tuesday. And it was a very testy news conference from Senator Parada, who was unhappy about the way that the whole thing had played out and basically called Senate Republicans unprofessional almost in the way they had handled their responsibilities as members of the Senate, that they had stalled this thing out for no good reason. And someone asked him about the well being poisoned, and he said, I'm not going to be drinking from that well for a while, you know, and he was just basically seemed frustrated with the whole process. And it does make you wonder a few things. I mean, first of all, and we'll get to this in a moment, the rest of the legislative agenda for the year. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, have we truly, and I don't think we know this yet, so we're just throwing it out there, have we truly changed the dynamic of budget processes here in the Capitol this year? I mean, has something finally snapped? I mean, even the governor was out on the road this year hinting that maybe he would support a majority-only vote instead of a two-thirds vote for
hinting.
A budget.
I mean, basically coming right out and saying it a couple of times. And today we saw Senator Parada, today Wednesday, Senator Parada drafting an open letter to the governor proposing a commission be formed consisting of the four legislative leaders and the Department of Finance, the head of the Department of Finance, to look at the budget process.
And the legislative analyst.
Oh, and the legislative analyst. Sorry, Liz. We didn't mean to slight
you. All due apologies to Liz Hill, the alleged analyst.
And to look at the budget process. You know, California is one of only two other states one of three states total. Sorry, we're doing afternoon. This is
the happy hour version of the podcast.
Yes, indeed.
And Anthony, and just so you know, everyone, Anthony has just put his newspaper, Capital Weekly, to bed, which publishes on Thursday. So,
and thank you for the violin serenade. You
know, he's a little brain tired. So yes, we're one of three states that has a 2/3
requirement. The other two being
Arkansas. And Rhode Island.
Yes, very good, very good.
Any good California budget reporter has to know that at this point.
Even the mediocre ones, like myself. and you know, really looking at this process, the 2/3 vote process. And today we saw the governor is going to be spending his day Thursday in Los Angeles with former Governor Pete Wilson and former Governor Gray Davis talking about redistricting reform. And there's some question now about whether if there's more sort of political reforms coming down the pike to appear on the ballot alongside term limits, an alteration in term limits, that may be other things like tweaking the vote threshold for passing a state budget might also be up for grabs here. Now, of course, this was tried eons ago in political terms in, 2004?
Right, for the budget vote.
Budget Accountability Act.
Right.
Trying to lower the threshold to 55%. How they came up with that number, I will still never know, but I'm sure Gail Kaufman will explain it to me at some point. Gail Kaufman, the political consultant who ran that ill-fated campaign for Proposition 55. But it's certainly in the air again, and I think now probably has some support, if not among Republicans in the legislature, then certainly in the Republican governor's office.
Well, I was going to say, because I think what's interesting about this is, I mean, this – you know, and again, this may be the happy hour podcast part of me coming out after a full day of work. But I do start to wonder if perhaps all of this gets back to what Arnold Schwarzenegger ran for governor in the first place, which was a clean kind of government reform kind of proposals out there versus the ones that he kind of jumped on in 2005, which, you know, quite frankly, were not clean. In other words, they had a partisan bent to them. They didn't. They weren't done in, you know, an open consultation with people on both sides of the political aisle.
Right.
So if he gets behind a redistricting reform that good government people support and runs that one on the ballot, that's going to be a lot harder to assail. If he does budget reform that's just a simple majority vote or something that has been vetted in some public setting some way and that's got bipartisan support, that's going to be a lot harder to beat up. I mean, maybe. Well, I know I'm being optimistic here, but it does seem like it gives the governor, who has an enormous amount of popularity with the voters still and could still pursue initiatives to get his goals met,
right.
It does give the governor an opening, it seems like, to go back and do things, for lack of a better term, the right way.
Well, and we'll see what this press conference tomorrow reveals. I mean, I think the Republicans, by holding out, have made a pretty good case for the need for redistricting reform. And we've talked about that on this podcast, just about how there was no reason for Republican senators to have to support this budget because there was no way to pressure them politically. They're immune in their own districts because of the strong Republican majorities.
Yeah, and their stance was enormously popular.
They were playing to a different audience, and there were no consequences for holding out. You know, we'll see what happens with Gray Davis and Pete Wilson tomorrow, but remember, we're getting ready for a presidential year. I think the environment is about to get a lot more partisan, a lot more toxic in that way as the presidential contest heats up. And I just can't imagine that Speaker Nancy Pelosi wants redistricting reform on the ballot in 2008. And I think that Democratic leaders, including Don Perata and even Fabian Nunez, would be hard-pressed to defy the Speaker of the House of Representatives. I mean, we'll see what happens.
Isn't there some irony to that, though? Because, I mean, there have been some people smarter than myself, you know, some university types and researchers and others who have concluded if we had had a different political map drawn in the last congressional election, Democrats would have probably won more districts than they had.
I mean,
because the tide was so strong that it would have actually benefited the Democratic Party to have had fair districts, for lack of a better term, drawn across the state.
But who knows where that tide will be in 2012, the next post-redistricting election will be in 2012. And that's what makes it difficult to the partisans who are trying to figure out how to get advantage in this. And I think but that's some of the cover that some of the good government folks have in terms of wanting to downplay the partisan nature of elections in the state. So
What do you think about, let's talk about the, this was the first budget for one of the four legislative leaders, Assembly Republican leader Mike Vallines, a Republican from the Central Valley, from Clovis. Mm-hmm. He's been getting a fair amount of good press and good PR. Not good press, because not really a lot of reporters writing about this right now. But a lot of good PR, it seems like, in political circles about how he handled the budget process. Are you hearing that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Although, you know, the last time we saw a Republican leader get this much praise, he got dumped for his efforts. I mean, George Plesha, the former Republican leader, Assemblyman now from San Diego, was the Republican leader last time around. They very quickly agreed to a deal. All the legislative leaders, you know, everybody heaped praise upon each other, and the caucus responded by dumping Plesha soon after the election.
How fast people turn.
But the difference this time around is that Vallines is getting praise from members of his own caucus, including the conservatives. They feel like they had their voice heard in this budget process, and it feels very different than what we saw. I think last year's budget was really a get-out-of-town-as-soon-as-possible budget so we can get on with the election. I mean, that was very much the flavor of the budget last year.
And then let's flip to the other side of the state capitol and Senate Republicans. And what does this do to the whole question of leadership over there? That was the subplot of this entire month, it seemed like, was what was going on behind the scenes of jockeying for who's going to be the next leader of the Senate Republicans. Dick Ackerman termed out, we think, if term limits reform doesn't happen,
right.
Termed out in 2008. There are already a cast of senators lining up to take his job. What do we make of the Senate Republican leadership structure, you think?
I think that was the joke going around the Capitol Monday. Oh, we got a budget. Does Dick Ackerman still have a job? You know,
right.
I think that remains to be seen as well. Probably not going to happen before the end of session, although if there's going to be a change this year, maybe it will. Who knows? I don't have a good read on what the internal politics are of that caucus, whether this holdout solidifies Ackerman's role as leader or whether it just bought him a couple more weeks and we may see a change before the end of the year.
And I do have to say, just as a kind of a way of wrapping that part up, it does make you wonder about the dynamics for a lot of things that are going to happen at the state capitol from here on out for one reason, and that is how these political caucuses operate. I mean, Senator Perotta, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, certainly talked about this in his post-budget press conference, the dangers of ruling by the slimmest of majorities of the caucus, the rule of eight theory in the Senate Republican caucus during this budget impasse, which was that 8 of the 15 had to agree on a path before they would allow the minimum number of votes to go up on the budget. And so if everything has to be done by the rule of 8 in the Senate Republican caucus, what does that mean for everything else? I mean, you know, California politics and other politics are, you know, the history is littered with lawmakers who, you know, who were strong leaders and kind of ran their caucuses in a certain way. I mean, and the rule of 8 just seems like a really difficult thing to put into practice.
Well, I mean, 2 years ago in the Democratic caucus in the Senate, it was the rule of 13. Remember, Dick Ackerman is not the only leader in the Senate to have won his post by one vote.
Right. Don Perotta, same way. Right?
When he was elected over Martha Escutia, it took 3 ballots, and it was a 13-12 election. So, and there were some consequences. I would just ask Reed Hastings, a former appointee to the State Board of Education, who came up for reappointment and was basically killed by Martha Escutia because of his stand on bilingual education. Okay, we've gotten way off base. Bring it back in. Point being, though, that that, you know, slim majorities, you know, the things you do to retain your slim majorities when your grasp on power is tenuous, I think this budget standoff reveals some of that.
And if anyone who is thoroughly sick of budget politics at this point thinks that all of this is kind of beside the point, one could argue that it is most decidedly not beside the point, because it definitely could influence the path of major policy debates from here on out, at least in the last 3 weeks of this legislative year. And the one that everybody certainly is talking about now, is wondering about, is health care and what's going to happen to health care reform.
Right. And we saw today the AARP had a large rally at the Capitol.
The red shirts.
Yeah, the red shirts, as opposed to the purple shirts.
I was going to say, as opposed to the purple shirts, because right. People who are around the state capitol know that, like, different interest groups kind of get these shorthanded names. Purple shirts refers to labor union members of the SEIU, who always wear their purple shirts when they're in the building. Right. Well, today it was a sea of red shirts of the AARP, and they even gave the governor one. And
It means they sat out this year so they can get an extra year of eligibility.
Maybe. Do you think the governor's a member of AARP?
Well, he's only 60, so I think.
But actually, I think the membership is 50 even.
Oh, well, I don't know. Is he a card-carrying member of the AARP?
Somebody from the governor's office, let us know.
Please.
But anyway. So, yes, they were there lobbying for health care reform. The governor spoke to them. Speaker Nunez spoke to them. Late on this day, we're taping this on Wednesday, we find that the governor, in an interview with the editorial board of the Sacramento Bee, said that the Democratic health care proposal as it stands, Assembly Bill 8, he would veto because it doesn't because largely it doesn't share the burden on anybody beyond businesses.
Right. And I think that that's not a great surprise to anybody, although it will mobilize various interest groups and prompt a sea of press releases to media offices, as we've already seen today. I don't think anybody's too surprised that the governor said he would veto AB 8 in its current form. You know, it's a negotiation. AB 8 is the beginning of the Democrats' negotiating position, and the administration has their own negotiating position, although not in legislative form. And we'll see in the next 3 weeks. We'll see if they can get anything. There's been some talk of maybe trying to break off a smaller piece and only offering universal care to children and, some sort of partial deal in order to salvage something this session. But
if you go back and look, and we haven't seen the full thing yet, and our full credit to the folks at the Sacramento Bee who will be running this story by the time all of you hear this on Thursday, if you go back and look at what the governor said to the ed board at the Bee, he kind of cut off that avenue there about taking part of it because he said, you know, we're not going to get another chance again if we don't do this the right way, which makes it sound like he's not willing to do half the enchilada. He wants to do the whole thing.
Well, and how you do that after the legislative council has said that you may need two-thirds to do it, another two-thirds vote. I just don't know how in this environment how you get that done.
Two words, ballot initiative.
Yeah.
I mean that really
either
may,
way.
That really
either
may
way.
Be the only thing left if you can't get if you're right, if you cannot get Republican support and you need them because it's deemed a tax increase to make this health care plan happen. And you know, and the governor's left open the idea of a special session. There are some of us who have asked him that question. I bugged him and tried to ask him that question today as he was touring a group of career tech exhibits on the lawn of the Capitol. And he said, I'd consider it. But then he said he thought there was the will, of course, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But
sure.
I mean,
as the last month demonstrates, of course.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Not a whole lot of goodwill lately. But I mean, there are some avenues. But I mean, ultimately, we've said this in this studio talking about a podcast on the podcast before, and others have said it around the Capitol. I mean, it may ultimately go to the ballot because it's so difficult to get consensus here at the state Capitol.
And I think it's inevitable, even if the legislature passes something like we saw before with SB2, the law passed in 2002, which would have required employers to provide health benefits to their workers. Even though that passed the legislature and was signed by Governor Davis, it was referended. I mean, it ended up going to the ballot box. So I think regardless, even if you get something through the legislature and signed by the governor, that we could still be talking about voting on health care issues in 2008.
And I just wonder, since it was so optimistic for the governor to put this on his agenda, you know, what happens? Where does he feel a personal stake, I wonder, in trying to make something happen or not let it fall apart at the end of 2007? And I hate to throw something else in the fire here, but what the heck? We're in the happy hour podcast, I'm calling this. He's already signaled that 2008 is his year of education reform. And so the conversation he's already planning, his advisors are already working on the State of the State speech for January, the conversation would move to another subject. And so what do you do then if you leave 2007 without having health care taken care of?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the volume on the conversation about health care is only going to increase in 2008. And not just in California, but nationally. I mean,
let's talk about the field poll. We saw some interesting numbers there this week.
Yeah, where you know a strong majority of Californians say they want something done on education. You've got one of the leading candidates for president in the Republican Party, Mitt Romney, touting his role in getting universal health coverage in Massachusetts. Certainly Hillary Clinton for the Democrats will be talking about health care, has been talking about health care on the stump. And I think we're seeing this year is finally the year that healthcare has been elevated to the top tier of issues on voters' minds. So, if nothing gets done this year, I don't think that just because the governor wants to talk about education reform in 2008, I don't think that that eliminates the possibility that we could also be talking about health care if nothing gets done this year.
Well, as we wrap up, we were going to do a shorter podcast, and now I'm looking at it about 25 minutes of rambling.
It's the happy hour effect.
It's the happy hour effect of doing a podcast. As we wrap it up, I mean, any final thoughts? I mean, are you just like I am, which is just kind of exhausted from the summer of discontent of the budget? I mean, especially, and I think I'm somewhat exhausted by it because there was no narrative. There was no good storyline other than the legislative Republicans are unhappy with the governor or this or that or something else.
A little Jerry Brown made it interesting.
Little Jerry Brown did kind of dip in there.
No, I mean, I think it's just, you know, watching this ramp up now, we're getting ready to go breakneck speed here over the next 3 weeks.
So in other words, I'm tired, it's going to get worse.
Well, you're tired from waiting around, but now pretty soon you're going to be tired from sprinting. So it's a whole different set of muscles.
What have we got? Just shy of 1,000 bills sitting in the hopper somewhere impending, right?
I believe that's the number. I'm not sure after the appropriations committees this week. I think that number will be whittled down significantly, but
a lot of issues.
Absolutely.
And more for us to ramble on and on and on about on this podcast.
Do you do that?
Hey, I'm not the only one.
I said we.
Oh, we do
I
that.
Said we.
I'm sorry.
It was not the editorial we.
It was not the royal
we.
Well, that'll do it for this budget edition of the podcast. For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio and the California Report. We'll see you next time.